I'm sorry, you don't want to hear this.
Yes, I do. I do want to hear this. I want to hear everything.
Everything?
Yeah, everything.
Starting with the Big Bang?
And we're back. Welcome once again to another episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar. We got another edition of MMO Interviews today. A really special one, something near and dear to my heart and my upbringing and my avoiding doing law school studying. This is Mike, Mike, and Oscar. I'm your co-host, Mike One. This is co-host also Mike.
Also Mike here. This was a great experience talking to Nick Kocher of Britannic. Recently, he has written for Saturday Night Live, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Along the Way, College Humor, Cracked, Break, Funny or Die. He's been in movies, Cartoon Network series, MTV Movie Awards. That's a hell of a filmography. It's a career I'm sure everybody would dream of having. He told us a lot of cool stories along the way. We focused on his origin story. We did a lot on the Britannic because of how it meant so much to you. Yeah. And my last few weeks where I really discovered him myself. So if you have not discovered Nick Kocher yet in terms of him and Brian McElhaney working together on Britannic, go seek that out. It'll be all over our Twitter, Instagram, Facebook feeds the next couple weeks.
Yeah, sure. It's one of those guys in Hollywood right now that if you don't know the name, soon you will. You but will. Even if you don't know the name, once you hear his voice, you'll be like, oh, I recognize that. He's done a lot of voiceover work too, working with Cartoon Network and other things. We hit on a bunch of topics. Like Mike said, our focus was primarily on his writing career, his creative process and how that's kind of run. We tried to work a through line from his work in Britannic, getting into comedy originally, and running that all the way through his most recent endeavors in Hollywood. Again, our pleasure to host and talk to one of the fastest rising voices in Hollywood in comedy, and a funny interview, great interview. We loved having him on, and hopefully we can have him on sometime in the future. Here is the MMO Interviews, one half of the duo Britannic, Nick Kocher. Enjoy it, guys. All right, MMOers on the line right now. We have Nick Kocher, one half of the comedy duo Britannic. He's also written for pretty much all of your and our favorite shows at one point or another. Nick, this is Mike One, also Mike, my co-host here. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Happy to be here.
We like to hear that. We appreciate you once again. Thank you so much for giving us a part of your time and just coming on and helping us find out a little bit more about you and helping our listeners know what it's like behind the scenes at some of the writing rooms here. Before we dive into your professional life, let's start at the beginning here. You've written for a bunch of shows, like we talked about. You've been on the writing staff for It's Always Sunny. You've been on the writing staff for SNL, two of the funniest shows ever, in our opinion, certainly. Can you tell us what got you into comedy just as a kid? What kind of any events happened that stick out in your mind as to why you decided to gravitate more towards the comedy genre?
I guess when I was really young, I wanted to be like good at something. And I was like getting bullied a lot in elementary school. And I kind of was just sort of like, this sucks so much of, I feel like maybe a strange attitude for a child to have of like, at that age being like, I need to, if I get good at something, people will leave me alone or will stop bullying me. But so I tried a bunch of different things. And like, I remember I wanted to be a cartoonist for a very long time, but there was also like, I remember being like, oh, maybe I'll be like the skateboarding guy. I wasn't good at that. And then I remember going to – I, like, moved schools a lot when I was younger, and I went to one school, and I lied and said I was a very good skateboarder, like, said I was essentially a professional skateboarder.
Oh, no.
That actually kind of worked for a while because kids were just like, oh, yeah, I guess he is. You know, when they saw me on a skateboard, it was like, oh, no.
the cover had been pulled back.
Yeah. And then around seventh grade, so I wanted to be a cartoonist for a long time. And then I kind of realized like, oh, I'm not that good at drawing, which I don't know that you do like at the time. I wanted to do like a Sunday comics type of thing. So like you don't need to be great at drawing for that. But I, for whatever reason, I was like, I'm not good enough at this. And then there was a year where I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I sort of found acting because I was a follower. I followed the popular kid basically wherever he went and just did whatever he did in hoping to that he wouldn't make fun of me. And so like, everybody auditioned for this play in sixth grade, and I got it was called The Trial of the Big Bad Wolf, and I was like, essentially a background extra in this play. I did not have any part at all, but I loved like watching the rehearsal process. And then there was also something about like being on stage and like having people look at you that I liked. So like I started, my parents were also really, were good parents, and they heard me say that I liked that. And so my dad signed me up for acting classes.
That's so cool.
So like that's kind of how I got into performing, I guess. But I was always, I always liked comedy. And I remember like from an early age, like trying to be funny at least. But I think it was like in junior high when I started like really being more proactive about it.
Now, Nick, you you and Brian grew up together in Atlanta, but you weren't necessarily lifelong best friends unless he was that popular kid you were just talking about.
Certainly.
why did you ignore slash hate each other as kids? And do you ever kick yourself, you know, for not forming this writing team much, much sooner?
Well, so we didn't really, so we were at the same, we went to the same preschool. We were at the same, you know, little league. We went to the same performing arts summer camp, but we didn't meet actually until the end of high school. So like there's like this photo that we have of the two of us doing like mime next to each other in 1999. But that was like, you know, 3-4 years before we actually were met. And we met through like a mutual friend. We went to different high schools and he sort of introduced us and we became friends very, very quickly. So they definitely didn't hate. We ignored each other, but because we didn't know the other one existed, I guess. And I don't know. It would have been, I mean, we formed, I guess we like officially formed Britannic in 2007, 2008. But we were working together before that. Like when we first met, Brian and his friend Travis were shooting a movie and they cast me in it.
Wow.
And we like, I think, shot about 2 whole scenes from that movie and then gave up.
But from out of that, the movie not working, you guys seemed to hit it off pretty quickly once you guys got your feet to the fire and started writing together, huh?
Yeah, we both had the very, very similar, same senses of humor. And so, like, we would just, like, we loved, like, quoting Brian Regan's stand-up bits to each other. And, yeah, we'd, like, show each other funny stuff. And then we ended up going to college together, not by choice, but sort of just by happenstance. And he was a film major and I was an acting major. So he would cast me in all of his movies and I would, like, improvise on top of the script. And then, like, junior, senior year, we were like, oh, let's start writing together and let's start actually you know, putting stuff
so online. Fate had other plans for you guys. This was destiny that Britannic was meant to be, is what you're saying.
Yeah, there's a Kurt Vonnegut thing in I think Cat's Cradle where he talks about, it's called a carass, where they're like, if there's somebody in your life that keeps showing up for unexplained reasons, that might be a member of your carass, which is a group of people that God has put together to accomplish something for it. And we were like, oh yeah, that's exact. I mean, we kept being in each other's lives until we started working together. So there was at one point where we thought about putting on our website, like, Britannic, God's work.
So did he help you write one of my favorite YouTube discoveries in a while, your high school graduation speech? Or was that all you, or was that all him, and you were his mouthpiece? How did that come about? Don't be an individual. It killed me. It killed the crowd. What a great speech.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for watching it. Yeah, that was actually interesting, because I always have, for the most part, written with somebody. Like, in high school, I started doing, like, how I really, I guess, went, like, my first proactive comedy step, aside from, like, being in plays, was our school had this assembly every Monday where, like, kids who were running clubs would come up and announce, like, when the club was meeting and all this stuff. And it was really long and really boring. And I made up a fake club called Darren's Dance Grooves Club. Darren's Dance Grooves was a regional choreographer, or I guess he was like a Los Angeles choreographer, who like released this video, and it was like, I'll teach you how to like do the choreography from this Britney Spears video and all of this different stuff. And he included, he said, like, if you call now, I'll include my like secret pop and lock style, or my secret street style pop and lock routine. So I started this club called Darren's Dance Group Club, where I was like, we're going to learn all the choreography from these videos, because it was a popular commercial that kids would make fun of. I would just do these like joking announcements. And I started that with my buddy Evan, and we would kind of write these little jokey announcements together. And they would also be kind of like fully plagiarized from like Tenacious D albums and stuff. And that got like, that I was sort of like alone in high school. I didn't really have many friends. And then when I started doing that, I started getting friends, and I started becoming like more popular. And it was probably one of the worst things to ever happen to me, because it completely attached my sense of self-worth to succeeding comedically.
And Pop and Lock, of course, was, you know, your early dating, you know, game in a way, right? Like you said.
So yeah, oh yeah, that's right. That's a big part of the speech.
Yeah, definitely.
So like, the speech, and then I was also writing for like the school newspaper. I would do like a humor article, and that I was often like bouncing the ideas off of friends and getting their input and getting their punch up and stuff like that. And so for the graduation speech, I was sort of like, I wanted it to be like something I did completely alone. Like, I didn't want my parents to help me with it. They would always help me with like my high school essays. And I didn't want like any of my friends to help me, because I just wanted to do something that was fully my own voice. And yeah, it was an interesting experience, because it like is one of the most fun things, one of the most joyous experiences I've ever had writing something, because normally writing can be a very torturous experience. But that was really fun. And I remember it just flowed out of me really quickly. And it was just like, I was like, oh yeah, I just want to tell embarrassing stories. And it's also funny, because the whole speech, for those of you who haven't heard it, go listen to it. It's on YouTube somewhere.
Yes, please do.
Yeah,
it's
we'll
definitely worth your time.
And there was like a whole section about like, so the whole speech is satirical, and I'm saying like, you shouldn't be an individual. You shouldn't, you know, go out and, you know, be unique, because then people will make fun of you. And one funny thing is that I say it's satirical. That's not totally true. I kind of mean it earnestly. I do kind of feel like most of my life I have been struggling to just, like, I would have been so happy to just be like a normal kid who is like ignored, and I just would keep embarrassing myself, and so I kind of learned, that's a lot where a lot of like my comedy came from, was learning how to like roll with the punches of embarrassing yourself. And
that's what I was going to say. It sounds like it was equal parts, you know, you did it for comedic effect, but also it was a bit therapeutic for you to get it out there in the open.
Yeah. And so what's funny is it was immediately followed by a speech saying to people like, be unique, lean into your individuality.
Perfectly timed.
Yeah. In my speech, I say something of like, don't ever dance.
Yeah.
That followed, they quoted the song "I Hope You Dance." So that was really fun.
So Nick,
yeah,
it sounds like it's all a bit of a confidence game for you throughout high school, working your early comedy routines there, and that did kill at the on stage, I must say. But we just discovered that you wrote an article for The Observer today. This is like the best part of our day. We discovered this article about you taking all these trips with your dad, and you climbed, was it Kilimanjaro?
Yeah, Kilimanjaro.
So I'm wondering if this confidence game was being affected by just nature humbling you severely every other weekend out with your dad. I mean, how did those, you know, trips work into all this?
I mean, that would be a nice poetic. But no, I was mostly just annoyed with all of the trips. My dad would like, is really big into canoeing, still is. And was constantly taking me on these canoe trips, and I was so often just bored by it. I am very grateful that it happened, because I can like sort of handle myself in the outdoors because of it. Hang on, there's a plane that's flying, I believe, 4 feet above my house.
That sounded like a helicopter passing by.
It was like, I don't know. Like at the time, all I just remember is being like, I just want this to be over. My dad had to bribe me to go on these canoe trips where he would be like we were going to do the whole Chattahoochee River, which is a river in the Southeast. God. And he did all of it. I did, I think, the first half. And he was bribing me by saying, like, I'll buy you a computer if you do the whole thing. And I should have sort of seen through, because it's like, I'm going to need a computer. Like, you need
right, that's a necessity to live.
Yeah. So, like, as soon as he got me the computer, I was like, I'm done.
Well, yeah, I can speak for both of us. You certainly made it farther with that halfway than either Mike or I would do left to our own devices. And if for those of you that haven't, go on nickkocher.com, that article in The Observer. I was in tears today, earlier today, reading it. It was hysterical.
Oh, thanks.
To get into more what you're known for, at least on the YouTube world, Britannic, obviously the comedy duo, the writing duo, you and Brian McElhaney, you've shared that it's kind of been your baby throughout the years. If I could just share a little piece of how I came upon it. Our listeners know I had the unfortunate experience of going through law school once upon a time.
Ugh,
and
terrible.
I was desperate to do anything but study at the end of my 1L year. I don't remember how I came across it, but I just came across the Britannic where Brian's going to be late for work. He doesn't wake up and you keep trying to wake him up in the interim.
Yeah.
That sent me down such a rabbit hole. I think I killed every video you had in your library up to that point, some like 6 or 7 years ago. And I spread those out to everyone I knew, my classmates, my family members. I was showing everyone Britannic. So like I said in the pre-production, I want to thank you for helping me get through law school first and foremost. And I'm sure I'm not the only one with that to thank you for.
Well, thank you. Thank you for watching. We need those views.
I want to ask, how much, it seems like such an improvised set there on Britannic. Basically, what's your writing process and what percentage would you say of what ends up on screen is an improvise or something that's actually started out on the page originally?
I would say like 98% is written beforehand. We like would really overwrite the fuck out of these sketches and like do draft after draft after draft. I mean, some were written very quick. I mean, there are exceptions. So there's a sketch we have called Everything, where it's like, I say to Brian, like, I hooked up with your girlfriend or your ex-girlfriend or something. And he's like, What did you do? And it's like, I want to know everything. And I'm like, starting with the Big Bang. And he's like, yes. And then I proceed to just tell him every single fact in the world. So that was a sketch we had the idea for the day that we shot it. And we had a live show the next day. So we were like, okay, we kind of like, very quickly we're like, I think that could work. I don't know. Is this too lame an idea? And we were like, yeah, we've got to film something. We had done this thing where we were like, we're going to have a new video every live show. We did that for 4 live shows. And then we were like, this is killing us.
Yeah. So do you guys write together? Are you in the same room working on this stuff together? Or you kind of go off in separate rooms? I mean, do you guys ever get sick of each other at this stage? I mean, you've been doing it for so long. I mean,
yeah, I mean, we definitely like, so just to finish Everything. So that was, we had that idea, and then we just, that was pretty much entirely improvised what those facts were.
Oh, wow.
Like we knew kind of structure of it, but we were just like, yeah, just set up the camera and I just sort of said shit and Brian kind of shouted some stuff out when he thought of it. But most of the sketches, yeah, it's always different. I feel like every time we write something, we have a different process. Like currently I'm in Los Angeles and Brian is in New York, which is like the longest period of our lives where we've lived in separate cities. Mm-hmm. We've been, I think, way more productive being apart a little bit, because what we found is like when we were – in the same city, we would meet every single day, and we would like it just be brainstorming ideas or writing ideas or whatever. And when you do that in the same room every day, you're kind of arguing over every single line. So for a 3-minute sketch, that's okay. But for like a feature, that is not really a viable means of working. What we've sort of found, like the past couple of things that we've been writing, we've been working on these longer projects, and we've worked a lot quicker because one of us will sort of outline it together and kind of be like, yeah, okay, that's kind of the rough structure, and then write up an outline, and then we'll kind of finesse it from there. But then one person will go and write the whole draft of either the sketch or the whatever, and then send it to the other person. And that's we've found that that's a much better way of working, is just once you have the whole structure of the piece, just one person goes and just bangs out the rough draft, and then we can then, you know, work from there. We've also done it where, you know, we wrote a movie once where it's like, I wrote pages 1 through 10, Brian wrote pages 10 through 20, I wrote pages 20 through 30, and so on. And that was like, that created the most chaotic script you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah, sounds like it, to be honest, yeah.
Mike,
yeah.
We got to learn from this, because
similar battles here, yeah.
Yeah, that makes so much sense, because if you're in the same room, you know, working with each other, you probably want to, you know, fantasize about, you know, hurting your co-host, Mike. I mean, your writing partner, Brian, there.
Yeah, either
for,
or.
For long stretches, but... So, I mean, you guys are performing at Upright Citizens Brigade years back, right? Is that happening during these Britannic years? Is that happening much later? You did a couple big shows there. You had a monthly show there for a while. When does UCB factor in?
So we came into UCB in a very interesting way. Like, I was aware of the theater. We were going to school in New York. I was aware of theater, but not really... It wasn't necessarily like right now, currently, it feels like such a viable way into the industry. Like, I think it actually does better. It's probably got a better success rate than NYU does. Huh. Like, just in terms of, or it is better at, like, I think giving you a means of like NYU, you kind of, you'd go to NYU, they give you like a couple chances to audition for agents. It's not really a great means of getting an agent, and then you're kind of just out, and you're like, yep, well, you know, good luck. Where UCB is like, you know, giving you a theater that you can perform at, that agents will come to, that there is like clout attached to that. And so I knew of it as a comedy theater, but I didn't really know how it worked. And I think I'd taken one improv class there. And then we, over the summer of 2007, decided to form Britannic, and we were like, let's start filming videos. So those first few sketches that we filmed, actually each one kind of were examples where one was written more by one person than by both of us, because we weren't comfortable like saying to the other person, this is bad, we need to make this better. But like Herpex was written, I think, primarily by me, and A Monologue for Thee was written primarily by Brian. And we went and filmed those two and another one that was actually not written. There's one sketch that was not written by either of us called A Talk with Dad that was written by Daniel Platzman, who is a friend of ours that went to this Performing Arts summer camp, who is now the drummer for Imagine Dragons.
Well, that worked out for him, I think.
And we were like talking about, yeah, we're going to film sketches. And he was like, oh, here's a sketch. And then basically came up with the word for word, the whole sketch. And we were like, yeah, okay, we're going to film that and pretend like we wrote it, I guess.
Well, it worked out well for you at the end.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, it's so we filmed these three videos, and I was like, I don't know why I necessarily thought to do this, but I was like, I'm going to submit us to sketch festivals. And we were having our buddy design a website for us, which took a very long time. And I submitted to the San Francisco Sketch Festival. I wonder if I if a friend had done it before. I don't even know. I'd heard of it somewhere, I guess. So we just submitted three, like, filmed those three filmed sketches. And then a month or two later, whenever, heard we got in. And they were like, you're going to do two live shows, like two 20-minute long live shows. And we were like, oh, shit, we've got to come up with a live show.
Oh, my
show.
God. So they forced it on you? It wasn't your intent to actually go live at that point?
Well, no, that was sort of what we were applying for. So we knew that we wanted to perform live, but it was just like we didn't send them tape of us performing live. We just sent them those videos, and we still will perform. We performed at San Francisco Sketch Fest this year. It was the first place we performed live. We basically put together a live show from some live sketches that I had written for this 24-hour play thing. And then I think we wrote a few more and just cast, like, had a bunch of my actor friends come out to San Francisco with us. Like, we didn't totally, it wasn't the best, like, strategy in the world because we had, like, six of us. It was more of, like, an ensemble, but we were, like, Britannic. So it was, like, a little confusing, I think. But we performed live. And it went great. I remember being so stressed out that day and just being like, I don't know if any of this is funny. Is this, you know?
Yeah, questioning yourself in the moment, like pretty much every professional, I'm sure. Yeah.
And then I remember, like, the first sketch we did was the sketch where it was like, we called it like the Dream Weaver, where I was a dream weaver who, like, comes to kids' bedrooms at nights and gives them dreams. And then I was competing with Brian, who was the Sandman, who did that. But he was just giving kids bootleg DVDs. It was a very bizarre sketch. And I remember crouched, and it's like I'm playing this big British foppy character. And I remember being crouched behind this chair where I'm about to, like, leap out and be like, hello, I'm the Dream Weaver. Oh my God, if this doesn't work, this is going to just be so painfully awkward. I have to, like, remain in this silly character the whole time. And then I remember our friend Kyle Williams, this girl, was playing one of the characters in sketch. She had the first line, and her first line got a big laugh. And we were like, I remember hearing that and being like, oh, okay, we're going to be fine.
Yeah, now we're safe.
And so SF Sketchfest, years later, you're opening for Robin Williams there. Did you guys meet him, hang
that
out?
That was that show.
Oh, my God.
Oh, goodness.
No wonder you're nervous.
Yeah. So that was like, we were watching the show. We watched, like, it was a bunch of different performers were going. And we were watching the show, and then there's, like, an intermission. And we go down to, like, the dressing room, and on our way down the stairs, we heard a barking sound behind us and turned around, and Robin Williams was like running down the stairs.
Oh my God.
Barking like a dog. And then we went into the green room.
As you always imagined you would meet him, yes.
Because that's where we were. And then he followed us in there because, of course, that's where he was going. And we were like, and he was just like, hi, I'm Robin. We were like, hi, yes, we're aware.
Yeah, you don't say.
And then he was like, are you guys performing? And we were like, yeah, we're up last, because we were scheduled to be up last. And he goes, ha, you were up last. And I'm dressed like an insane British dream weaver.
So this interaction, like, was happening while you were still in costume?
Well, we weren't in costume yet, but okay. Then we were in costume backstage, and he was sort of making fun of us.
That's amazing.
And he was like, great job. And who knows if he ever actually watched it, but it was like, that was, you know, I was riding high on that compliment for a while. And then we watched him. So then he then did like an hour of stand up after that. It was an incredibly auspicious beginning. But anyhow, we did that live show and we taped it, or one of them we taped. Because we did two while we were there. And then I just submitted that to the UCB along with the film videos. And they gave us an audition slot, which they call a spank slot, which is like they give you a 30-minute slot at like 6 p.m. And, you know, you see how you do. The artistic director goes to see the show and is like, either gives you notes, says, great, you can do a run, or goes, no, you, like, this is bad. And we were really nervous and did the show. And Anthony King was the artistic director at the time. He's now a very successful writer. He just wrote the Beetlejuice musical. And he was like, this is great. Like, you know, do a run. And we didn't know. If I'd known more about the theater, I think I would have probably done things very differently, because I didn't know that that was very unusual for them. Like, so much of – a lot of the criticism of the theater is that they don't give performance slots to people who don't take their classes, that aren't, like, involved in that community.
Yeah, they're probably willing to make an exception for Robin Williams' opener, though, I would think.
Well, sure. I mean, I don't know that they knew that.
right. I think that's an amazing story.
I think actually that was also maybe specific to Anthony King, like, because I think with the Spanx, even the Spanx slots are, I think, a little bit tricky to get, like, because they are, people want them. But we'd never taken any, like, sketch writing classes, which I think was really, you know, at times in my life, I think that's good. And at times I think, oh, maybe we would have benefited from some, but, like, we very much, like, had our own, like, sort of taught it to ourselves a little bit based on just watching, you know, other really accomplished sketch people, which I think kept us a little bit maybe away from, like, some of the more formulaic sketch stuff that's out there.
It's definitely provided you with a unique voice that you guys have been honing over the years and perfecting, dare I say. I want to move on from Britannic to get into a couple of shows that you wrote for, but I have two questions that if I don't ask, my brother, I think, will disown me. So I have to just ask if you'll indulge me about Britannic for two more questions. One, in the sketch of Teamwork, is that Rachel Bloom who's cast as the quote-unquote ugly roommate that you give the name Bridge Troll to?
Yes, that's Rachel Bloom. She went to college with us and was doing, I think maybe she, I don't know if she was at the time that we filmed Teamwork. It was like, I'm remembering that sketch we also kind of slapped together pretty last minute. I think it was for a competition or something. And I think it was for some video submission competition where, like, the theme was teamwork or something.
Oh.
And there would be... I don't totally know. I think it was, though. Yeah, I, like, knew Rachel a little bit, but not too well, and just asked her if she'd do it, and she was like, yeah, and she was great, and I'll see her around LA a lot, and she's always so nice and great, and it's been incredible to watch her blow up.
Yeah, that's amazing. I was just, looking. That's one of those things you look back on and you're like, wait a minute. I know that face. And then she's up there winning Golden Globes, which I'd like to think is in no small part due to your work there with her in Teamwork. So congratulations to you.
I will take full credit.
The other question, I know eagles are turning people into horses was a homework assignment. It was a presentation for Brian, correct? That wasn't your class assignment, right?
Yes, that was Brian's. It's what he calls, and I think the other kids call it the thesis film. Wow. But, like, I was sort of like, that is not what a thesis is. Like,
Slam Dance will have something different to say, though, right?
I'm like, why is it called a thesis film? It's like you're graduating from a Bachelor of Arts degree. It's not like a – I don't know. So, but they called it thesis film. So it's like – yeah, so that was like in the film program. I mean, there's a bunch of different like paths you can go down, but the one that I think it's a lot of people do is there's you are given your senior year, you pitch a short or whatever you want to make to your class, and they have an allotment of, I want to say, $10,000. It might be less. It's like $10,000 worth of equipment and space and stuff.
Right.
And you have to pitch your short to the class, to the teacher, and I think the teacher approves it. Anyhow, Ryan was going to do like his own thing, like a dramatic sort of short, which I remember he was going to have me play a part in, And I still don't know what this is about, but like the costume for it, because he's like, I have to take some photos, like character photos. So like get wear this costume, which was a blazer tucked into jean shorts. And I was like, this is a drama that you're making. I think he bailed on that idea and he was like, why don't we use this as a Britannic short? And I was like, okay, sure. And we were going to do this other idea for a while. And then that was like going to be too hard to put together. And then he was like, oh, why don't we do this script that I wrote when I was in Dublin? Because he'd done the abroad program in Dublin and he'd written this crazy, like longer sort of sketch where it was like basically just an earlier version of Eagles. But it was the government was turning people into horses. And it was a guy who had brought a girl home with him and he didn't want to hook up with her. So he was like enacting this plan to like, I was sort of like, yeah, this is insane and very funny. And then we rewrote it over like a weekend, but it still wasn't quite right. And I was like, we have to like film this next weekend. Like, I don't know that we're going to get this together in time. And then he pitched it to his teacher and the teacher like was like, is this a fucking joke? And he didn't get the allotment of money and equipment. And I was like, cool, all right, well, we're not doing it. And Brian was like, no, we can borrow the equipment from somebody.
Nice.
Where there's a will.
Yeah. Then we filmed it at my grandfather's house that was like just outside of New York. And we'd like, I was like against shooting it until he said like, this one day he was like, I've got this crazy idea, or I've got an idea that's going to like fix everything. And I was like, okay, what is it? And he was like, I was at this costume store and I saw this large costume of an eagle. I was like, what are you talking about? Idea. That's, you want to just throw an eagle into this already insane script? I was like, what is this supposed to be? Eagles are turning people into horses? And
yes, then both of us
were like, oh my God, that's it. And for whatever reason, changing it from the government turning people into horses to eagles turning people into horses made a lot of things click. I think because we were like, why would the government want to turn people, like the government is people. Why would it turn people into horses? And then we were like, oh, but eagles would want to turn people
of
into
course.
Horses.
Naturally, that's yes, of course. Well, as an Oscars podcast, that's basically the main reason. That's certainly an award-winning and award-caliber film, so I wanted to bring it to everyone's attention. Before we move on, I need to know who came up with the ginger ale line in Eagles Are Turning Peoples Into Horses by Alex Anfranker. My brother and I recite that joke probably 7,000 times since we've watched it
years ago.
Tell
us it really happened.
So there was that chunk of the script. That was like the last thing we added. It was that chunk of the script was – it was – initially from the first draft of the script was a line where it's like, I'm telling the girl, you know, this is like, you know, this is the lie you'll tell people if you're caught. You'll tell them that your boyfriend wanted to break up with you, but he couldn't because he was afraid of like confrontation. So he came up with this elaborate lie about horses and eagles or whatever. So like that was there. And then I was sort of like, I want to improvise a bunch of shit on top of this. Like, I think, like, when I go into the reasons why we've broken up, like, I want to just, like, go nuts. And then when I was, like, rehearsing with Laura Ramade, who plays Hannah, and Alex Anfanger, who plays, God, what's his character's name? Frank?
I don't even remember.
Frank. Yeah. We were rehearsing and I was like, I feel like Frank should have something that he's also upset about. he should get in on the yelling. And then I feel like both me and Alex take credit for the ginger ale line, for it being ginger ale. In my head, I was like, I think he's upset about something like she stole his ginger ale. Also possible. Alex went like, oh yeah, what if I'm upset that she stole my ginger ale? And so then we just filmed It was like all improvised. So it was never actually like, if you were to look at a script for Eagles, which I don't know how you would find because I don't, that none of that's written out. So it was all just improvised. And then Brian, like I did like three different monologues thinking we would just use one, and Brian edited them all together.
Oh, good God. What a feat. Well, thank all four of you for that, because it's added a lot to my life personally.
Good.
We love hearing these origin stories, but my brothers will kill me if I don't ask about the two big shows, because they're the funniest shows in my life for the last 20 years or so.
Certainly.
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Let's start with that one if we could. And I'm just dying to know what that writing experience has been like for you guys. Have you tasted rum ham? What's the gang like over there? How do you do over there at Sunny?
Well, that was like such a fun job interview, because we were hired by Megan Gans, who's a writer who wrote for Community and for many years, and then Modern Family, and then Always Sunny, and she's working on some other shows.
So, stupid question: Brian's not related to Rob, or is he?
No, he's not. That's just a crazy coincidence. Yeah, they also kind of look similar, which is like. Yeah. A very bizarre thing. So we were like, I remember we were like really desperate for a job, because we had been the voices of Cartoon Network for 6 years, and that job had, and that paid for everything. So it was like kind of let us, you know, we didn't have to take any job we didn't want. And we, you know, we were just, And we were a little bit, I mean, like we were still doing stuff and being proactive, but we didn't have like the fire of we need to like feed ourselves underneath us. And so the Cartoon Network job ended, and it was like we didn't have any prospects for jobs. And we were like, oh, no.
Yeah.
What do we do? We need to get a job. And so we were set up we had a bunch of meetings for a bunch of different shows, and like, some, I won't name names, but some terrible shows. Like, there was like these, you know, those like animated shows that are based on the movie.
Oh no.
Yes.
And these weren't Disney things, but like there was like some animated shows based on the movie that we met on, that we were like pitching for our lives. We were like, we would love to work on this show.
It's always been a dream of mine. Yeah.
Dream to do the spin-off, like the knockoff with like sound-alike actors of the show that'll be on like Netflix Kids or whatever. And then we didn't get those jobs, and I was just like kind of freaking out. And our manager was like, our manager also represented Megan Gans, and he was like, oh, I think Always Sunny is staffing up soon. And I was like, yeah, I mean, that'd be a dream. But I was just like, the freaking like kids cartoon show just turned us down.
Oh gosh.
I have high hopes. And then they were like, he was like, for the meeting, they want you to just come in and pitch a couple episodes. Hmm. And so I was like, oh, that's kind of intense, because that's
sure.
Most writing meetings you're not doing right. That so, but it was so fun. I was already like such a massive fan of Always Sunny, so I just rewatched the most recent season, and like really quickly we came up with a bunch of episodes. Like it was just a very like, we were like, oh, what about this and this and you know, and then we went in and met with Megan Gans, and we're still friends with Megan to this day. And a moment that I knew we would all become good friends and remain that way is we were meeting over at the Fox lot. I think we were like 10 minutes late. I think she was like 15 minutes late. And we both admitted in the first 5 minutes of this job interview that all three of us were hungover.
Again, serendipity coming into play here.
This is different. And then we like pitched a couple of the ideas, and we got along with Megan really well. And then everybody I knew that knew Megan, I basically contacted and told to write her like to recommend, like to, like to vouch for us. So she probably got 40 emails from friends being like, hire these guys. and then, yeah. And it was such a, it's a really relaxed room. They don't, you know, it was, it's some writers' rooms go from like 9 a.m. to like 2 a.m. You know, if you're not lucky, they're done by like 4:30.
Oh,
it's, they know what they're after. And they were also like very, one of the things in the job interview was Megan was like, do you guys write more like, do you like doing punch up? Like, do you like joke writing or do you like coming up with situations? And I think we gave some like half-assed answer. We're like, we like both. because she was like, because they typically like the room is mostly used to come up with the situations. They like, you know, they don't need joke writers. They do that all themselves. Right. They like fill in all of the like texture and comedic, you know, all that stuff kind of at the end. It's a good way. It's definitely like the way that Brian and I also kind of write is not coming up with the, you know, one liner first, but coming up with the sort of tension and conflict and having the humor come from that.
You guys certainly have excelled at that, especially with your skit writing over the years. I guess the last question, because I know we're kind of pressing you on time here, the last question before the last question here, having that relaxed atmosphere with Sonny, is there any way you can kind of compare and contrast it to your time, what the writer's room is like at SNL or getting a skit created or a pitch done at SNL as compared to that laid back, more so atmosphere you just described with Sonny?
Well, that's exactly it. It is not laid back at SNL. A much more intensive, you know, the hours are literally Tuesday, you work all night.
good Lord. Yeah, we've heard that.
Is that still all night? Like you all nighter every time?
I mean, it's different for different people. Some people, you know, finish their stuff by 3 a.m. and then go home and are, you know, basically they're the smart ones. Other people, you know, don't sleep at all. They work till like, you know, there's some writers who don't turn in their scripts till like 15 minutes into the table read. Like the table read has already started and they are like finishing up something. It just depends on how many things you're writing, how that has gone. So you're not required to be there all night by any means, but it's just sort of, that's what's done.
Wow. Sounds very labor intensive, but I obviously, you know, you do get to live the dream, I guess, in quotes here, at least because of how hard you work, but you're living the dream for a writer working SNL there.
Yeah. How do you thrive in that atmosphere? It feels like from the outside looking in, it feels like a sketch comedy competition with like the best comedy writers on the planet all involved. Is it pressure packed? Does that help the comedy? What is the atmosphere?
I think it helps some. I think the people that work well in that type of environment work well in it. And I think some people, I think probably most people don't. I don't know that it's, you know, like there's an interesting, I feel like I'm kind of in the middle of it where it's like, I do like an intense deadline and then like in doing writing sprints like that rather than taking a lot of time. But it's also like, you know, I definitely do my best work when I'm well slept and comfortable.
the audacity. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that's great about it though, is that you get to, is everything, every other job in the entertainment industry is like you write the thing, you like, pitch the thing over a couple months, and then a couple months later you maybe get to write it, and then a couple months after that you maybe get to film it, and then like a year after that maybe it airs on TV or in theaters. And at SNL it's like, you know, you pitch on Monday, you write on Tuesday, you find out Wednesday if you're going to get to make it, and you find out Saturday if it's going to go to TV. So it's like a very quick turnaround, which is really nice, because the waiting game is equally not fun. I think it's like, it's stressful because it's like, what I've said is like, a week at SNL is like a year in the entertainment industry with all of the,
it certainly sounds like
the high of that year all compressed into 5 days. So it's like, you know, high highs, low lows, right on top of each other.
I can't even imagine. And credit to you for getting to that point, you and Brian both. And if you want to catch Nick and his latest work, you can obviously check out Britannic.com, BRITANICK.com. Check out Britannic's YouTube channel here. Nick, we're going to be popping up all over the Hollywood spectrum in the coming months as well with some stuff, hopefully. So we'll see how that goes. But Nick, we have a little bit of a tradition here at MMO. We want to get you out of here on what is our last question. We always ask our guests if they wouldn't mind pitching us what their version of the worst movie possible would be. So I ask you, and your creative genius and your comic and your background here, if you could just indulge us, what is Nick Kocher's version of the worst possible movie ever made?
Worst possible movie. I mean, God, I part of me just wants to pitch an existing movie that I talk about. I mean, I think it would be so long. It would just be very, very long.
So far you're pitching Avengers Endgame. Keep going.
No.
But it would be very slow and there wouldn't be many cuts. So it would be like, you know, the movie would open with a one take, like a one-er. And it would be the longest one of all time, and it would be the least impressive one of all time, because it would be a locked-off tripod shot of, like, a chair at a dining table. The movie would be called The Table, and there'd be, like, and it would be, like, cinema verite, where it would be, like, we're not putting any narrative on this at all. You're just going to see what happens in the day of the table.
God. The movie...
12 hours long, and then right in the middle of it, there's just some like really graphic, gratuitous violence, like for no reason, and it's not. And the dialogue is not well written. It's like that's something that I hate. Is if it's like you're watching something truly that is like kind of triggering and terrible to watch, and it's not well done. Mm. Like that's crazy to me. So anyhow, yeah, the movie's called The Table. It's rated NC-17.
That qualifies. That's terrible. Is a terrible movie.
That's wonderfully terrible. Thank you.
Nick Kocher, thank you very, very much once again for giving us a piece of your time. We have so many more questions for you. Hopefully we can get you back on at some point in the future. But good luck to you, and thank you from the bottoms of our hearts for everything you've done for me personally, and Britannic's done for me, and for both Mike and I here. We really appreciate you giving us a piece of your time.
You are very welcome. I completely understand what a big deal this is for you.
I'm glad. Yes.
This is so fun, guys. Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot, man.
Cool. Bye, guys.
See ya. I don't know why such talented people keep agreeing to talk with us, but I'm grateful that they do, and I couldn't have been more gracious for Nick Kocher. Really appreciate him coming on and helping us out and give us a little bit of his time.
Yeah, after you said like 5 goodbyes to him.
I didn't want to let him go.
Yeah, you were like, I could talk to him for days.
I was like Rose on the Titanic, except I would have held on, damn it.
I also want to, you know, embarrass you further and say that when I walked into the room today, you were like, this man is the voice of my inner monologue.
Yeah.
He's the voice of my inner monologue because I listened to him throughout college so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, post-college life. I appreciate you bringing that to light. Yeah. No, look, in all sincerity, law school was not a fun time for me. And the Britannic sketches really did help me get through a lot of studying and a lot of me losing my mind studying over con law and some other classes
that I had to go through. Just listening to one title about it.
So, but that was our interview with Nick Kocher, one half of the Britannic writing duo. Again, like we just talked about, his time at SNL, Always Sunny in Philadelphia, involved in some huge productions, and hopefully we're going to see him in a lot more things coming up in Hollywood.
Go out and seek his stuff out. He is Emmy nominated for SNL. He was nominated for a Streamy for Next Time on Lonnie back in 2014. The staff of SNL won a Writers Guild Award in 2018, 2019 nominated again. So he's an award-winning writer in his own right. He's been in movies, Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing, which was a really cool Joss Whedon movie, a never would have thought Joss Whedon would have made that movie, but of course he did. Balls Out, Dude Bro Party Massacre 3, some comedies there, Searching for Sonny, and then he had a bit part in The Amazing Spider-Man, go figure. So
yeah,
this guy's super talented performer, writer, he's everywhere. We only scratched the surface and everything we wrote down, and we had a humongous document today because you know, he's just so accomplished, and it was great to just dive in and talk about those subjects. And really, we dove in deep to a couple of big subjects that were near and dear to our hearts throughout these last few years, of course, for me and for you a long way back.
Yeah, and comedy's kind of been our corner lately for interviews here. We obviously do the awards, not to step on Clayton Davis's toes, but the awards circuit stuff. The awards circuit, the experts.
We get them on too.
We've had a couple, luckily enough to have a couple big voices in comedy, rising voices in comedy. And look, we love hosting. We think it's a treat for us. We think it's a treat for you guys. And hopefully you see it the same way. We want to know genuinely, what is your reaction to these? Did you enjoy the interview? Are we turning you on to any new talents through this MMO interview series? It, again, is our honor and our pleasure to bring that to you. And it's just as much fun, hopefully, for us as it hopefully is for you. So we certainly plan on doing more so in the future, bringing you more interviews and bringing to light more talents that are on the verge of the come up like Nick is.
Yeah, go to Britannic.com, like Mike said during the episode. He's also Nick Kocher, that's with a K-O-C-H-E-R, on Instagram, at Nick Kocher on Twitter. He's at NickKocher.com as well. He's all over the place. Go on IMDb and seek out all the stuff he's done and purchase it.
Yeah, that's good advice. It might be your words of wisdom.
I'm new to the pitch game, the ad game, though, in the promotion world. But all right, I got it done.
If you could reach out to us, let us know your comments, thoughts, concerns, questions, anything about any of the more recent MMO episodes. You can reach out to us. We are Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, at MM and Oscar on Twitter, MikeMikeAndOscar.com, MikeMikeAndOscar@gmail.com, and MikeMikeAndOscar on Reddit. We are available everywhere you hear podcasts. Tune in, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, etc., etc. Michael, even though you did a good sell job there, that probably should be your words of wisdom. Try not to screw this up. What are your real words of wisdom here?
When a professor tells you you cannot make a movie about eagles turning people into horses, scoff at that professor and make the movie anyway.
I hope that professor is A, not famous, and B, feels like a horse's ass now.
It was James Franco. Yeah. No, I mean, they made that movie, and that was, of course, Nick's words of wisdom, or Brian's words of wisdom in that instance. And they made that movie, and it all kicked off from there. What a hell. That was a hell of a college short film. I laughed like an idiot during just the first lines of that movie made me laugh.
I can't tell you the number of times I have made that ginger ale joke.
I had like 17 horse or eagle jokes that I did not say because I didn't want to interrupt the great Nick Kocher during our interview, but I did have them. I'll make them on randomly at the worst moments in our upcoming
I class. Appreciate it. And maybe we could have him back sometime. That'd be a treat too. Maybe Brian as well. Guys, when reality sucks, keep watching movies with us and we will catch you next time.
Hey, what's up, guys? Oh, hey, have you met my cousin?
Yes, we have. Very good to see you, Brian.
Cool. How'd you guys meet?
I think through Ben.
That's it. Through Ben. Good old Ben. You going to his party on Saturday?
Ben's having a party?
And you weren't invited, so I gotta redo this and wreak havoc on the time-space fucking continuum.